If you always think that you're right, then you must hold your theology as being static. You can't grow from that point. We won't be able to come to the table with all of the tools available if we are so in conflict with something that we take it off the table. And that impoverishes the options that can be created when you don't have all of those tools on the table. So in understanding what we're bringing to the table, I need to put what I think are my for real understandings right now, I need to put them on hold for a moment. That doesn't mean that I get rid of them. It means that I'm holding on to them while at the same time I'm opening the door. It's not keeping something else out.
Welcome to Language of God. I'm Jim Stump. Back in the studio with me today is BioLogos President Deb Harsma.
Happy to be here, Jim.
We just heard some wise words on dialogue and theology and certainty. Whose words were those?
That was Dr. Elizabeth Conde Frazier, and I got to interview her recently in our studios. It was a great conversation. She's a theologian and a pastor, and she has a real passion for theological education. She's been a leader at several seminaries around the country, and she's the author of A Many-Colored Kingdom.
So where did you meet her?
I was invited to a conference of Latino pastors and seminary leaders. This was a group called the Association for Hispanic Theological Education. And I ran into Elizabeth, and the first thing she said to me was, I just saw this picture of this amazing colorful shrimp. And this was an email I'd written for BioLogos about the mantis shrimp. So it was fun to meet her and see her passion for science and faith. She is head of a network of Hispanic Bible Institutes, which equips Latino pastors and faith leaders.
So her work hasn't exactly centered on our topic of science and religion like many of the people we interview, but it does intersect with our work in several places, right?
Yeah, it really does. She, in this interview, talks about how pastors can mentor young people and help them think through the big questions. She touches on evolution and education and medicine and how those issues play out in immigrant churches. Oh, and she has this beautiful story of being around a campfire with friends, looking at the stars. I don't want to spoil too much, but she's become a great role model for others who are navigating big questions.
And she talks specifically about the importance of role models.
She does. It's really sad to hear how many kids in this country don't have any concept of what it would be to be a scientist or an engineer or a doctor. And we need to show kids that they can pursue their curiosity about the natural world and their curiosity about God. They don't have to leave either one behind.
On our website, biologos.org, we have the stories of many other role models who found harmony between science and their Christian faith. And just a couple of years ago, we published a book called How I Changed My Mind About Evolution, which gives the stories of 25 people from a range of different backgrounds. But for now, let's focus our attention on Dr. Elizabeth Conde Frazier.
Let's get to the conversation. All right, well, I am here today with Dr. Elizabeth Conde Frazier, and I'm so delighted to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Wonderful. So I am excited to talk with you about how theological education and the Hispanic community intersects with issues of science and Christian faith. But let's start by just letting our listeners get to know you a little better. So tell me more about where you grew up and your faith background.
So I grew up in New York City, Brooklyn, as a matter of fact, and my family was an immigrant family from Puerto Rico, and I was in a very multicultural church because there were about 14 to 21 different countries represented, and so people say Hispanic and they think we're all one, but we're not, and so we had a lot of learning to do from each other. Learning how to live with one another, what we ate, what we called things, our different histories, the different stories of how we came to the United States and why. And we did everything in the church, everything that we couldn't afford to do. So instead of going to Broadway to see a play, we put plays on ourselves.
That's great.
And that included a comedy in the summertime and so forth. teaching was a part of our lives, not only what one thinks about in terms of teaching in the church, like Sunday school or Bible study, but we had to teach each other how to get along in a new culture. We had to teach each other a language, a new language. We taught each other different jobs so that we could get a job. So we taught sewing. We taught when computers came out, we started teaching people that. We taught cooking. We taught whatever could get somebody a job. We would teach each other that. Oh, and we opened that up to the community as well.
Yeah. Oh, I love hearing that about how, the strength that you drew from having so many different cultures in one church and the way you could teach each other. That's great. So how did you develop a passion for theology and theological education?
I grew up with teachers around me and loving to teach. So I started teaching Sunday school when I was 11 years old. Mm-hmm. And I was being mentored. And from there, this was interesting. The pastor at the time was a person who could sort of call out gifts in persons. And he told my mom that I was going to be, you know, a teacher of teachers. Mm-hmm. And so he allowed me to do a lot of things along with adults, and where adults were paying attention to what I said. I was leading adults. Could you imagine that?
Wow.
Now, of course, they didn't need me to lead them. Right. But the fact that the pastor put me in that position and that it was a church that could listen to the voices of the young because it was a mentoring church. And that was very important to who we were as a church.
Oh, that's a beautiful identity for a church to have, and to be identifying teenagers like that to come and do things alongside adults. I think so often our churches just kind of segregate all the ages out, and they don't have that intergenerational thing, or the naming of a young person, like, you could be a good teacher and a teacher of teachers. I love that. So tell us more about the immigrant experience. My immigrant ancestors are like from 150 years ago, so it's way outside of my knowledge and in a very different world. But what's it like today and the different generational gaps? What's that dynamic like?
Well, the generational gaps will occur because while the two generations are standing in the same time and space, if you will, what's taking place is that the first generation, those who came here after the age of 18, have been shaped and formed by country of origin and their values, their understanding of how life should move forward, their expectations, their reasons for being here are very different than the generation that is born here or whose formation is going to take place here in their professional life because they came here between 5 and 17. And that means that this 1.5 generation or the second generation, we're looking forward at what is taking place here. And the experience in the host country is what is shaping us, our worldview, our understanding of ourselves, of what are our goals, and so forth. And those things are going to conflict with one another. Mm. For some, that means that language may also be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not speaking the same language. If that is the case, sometimes if the parents and grandparents don't speak the language of the host country, then it's the new generation that is having to lead. Mm-hmm. And that's a role reversal.
Mm, yeah.
That role reversal will also change the trust relationships between parents and children. Mm-hmm. And it causes children to sometimes see their parents as persons who can't lead and guide them.
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought of that. Okay.
And then it depends on whether you are a person of color or not coming into this country, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and what your social status is, right? Your economic status.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're poor and you're a person of color, that will add to it the fact that you're living in a community that has less resources, and communities with less resources tend to have more violence attached to them. And that also exacerbates what happens between the generations. The first generation is not going to be home a whole lot. They have mm-hmm. 2 and 3 jobs in order to be able to make it. Mm-hmm. And that means that in a sense, you're sort of brought up by the street a little bit. Schools don't have a lot of extracurricular activities and so forth. And this is where the church becomes key. The church as a place where generations can come together and do culture together, reflect about what it means to be in this country, share their different journeys between generations, mm-hmm. because our journeys in this country are different. We don't tend to have time to talk about this with one another. We just speak out of our frustration of, these are my expectations, but this is what you're doing. And to have a space to talk about those expectations, to talk about what our days really look like, to identify with one another, that helps us as generations to come closer. Wow, I didn't know my parents were going through all of this. Mm. Look at what's taking place. So now there's a different way to come together and to solve problems together.
Yeah. So what's it like then for a pastor pastoring a congregation like that? What are some of the unique challenges that they face?
Well, it depends on whether the pastor is also a first generation or a second generation. Okay. If the pastor is also a first generation, the pastor is kind of in the same space as those parents, right? Mm-hmm. That pastor is having to find ways to network, to learn the language, to figure out where the resources are for those families, and to help those families to navigate the new culture.
So I'm picturing a pastor in a congregation like that with a lot of first generation and second generation immigrants. And so you've got like high school kids who are keen on science, maybe, and parents encouraging them to go into the science careers. And I know the kinds of tensions that leads to in like the white evangelical churches I've been a part of. But what does that look like in the Hispanic context?
Well, there's a variety of things, right? If you are evangelical and you've been told that we don't descend from the monkey, et cetera, then it's science against faith in a sense, right? Because your understanding of how to interpret the creation narrative is different than how science is presenting what took place. And that becomes a real conflict across generations, as well as a faith conflict, right?
Yeah.
Kids are in school and they're learning science differently. It makes sense to them. But then they come to church and they're being told that this is part of what they need to separate themselves from. Yeah. It's not a dialogue. It's just a command. Right? Mm. You shouldn't be a part of this. This is going to lead you astray. So this is a forbidden area. Mm. Therefore, it's not an area that we can openly discuss. And right. So it's forbidden. That's all that I know. And it leaves me as a young person without knowing how to navigate the two pieces, right? Mm-hmm. For some pastors, Sunday school material is actually helpful. That's how I connected with it. And so that piece is what allowed us to ask questions, to get into it. We didn't have as many resources as we now have and as your organization is offering. I think that it's such a richness that's being offered by BioLogos, but we didn't have that. Nonetheless, we were permitted to ask questions. We were permitted to navigate these waters. And there was a dialogue between the two pieces, and the information in the Sunday school material was part of what helped us to navigate it.
So you've mentioned Hispanic Bible Institutes a few times, and you are now coordinating work with Hispanic Bible Institutes with the Association for Hispanic Theological Education. So tell our listeners more about that initiative and the role it plays in Hispanic churches and so forth.
Well, the Association of Hispanic Theological Education began in 1990 because there wasn't enough access to theological education for the Latinoa community. Persons wanting to go from a Bible Institute to, let's say, a Master's of Divinity program didn't have the access to do that. There's a BA missing somewhere. Mm. But if you are a person who is beyond your 30s, you're in your 40s or 50s, going back to do all that in the midst of all these economic pieces as well is very difficult. So what does theological education need to look like in a Latinoa community where persons really are thirsty for more so that they can be more effective in their ministries, right? As you can see, there are many challenges and we need it to be more effective. The other part about being more effective is that even for those of us who did have access to a master's degree in divinity, the courses weren't contextual. Mm. And we had to do all of this translation between cultures for ourselves, and it's very expensive. So here you are paying for, a lot of education that is at times even miseducating you.
So the theological education, it's all contextualized, like with examples from white churches and not examples that are relevant for these pastors?
Right. And in the area of counseling, you don't have the counseling pieces that are needed for when persons are doing these shifts that we've just been talking about. Mm-hmm. In the area of history, you're not including anything that has to do with church history related to who we are, right? Christianity takes place in our different countries and so on and so forth. You're invisible. Right?
Yeah.
When you're talking about Bible, you're using different methods for doing interpretation, hermeneutical methods that, again, are not related to who we are. So it's not that we're rejecting everything that we've been taught. It's just that, sure, give us this, but also there are these other missing pieces that are necessary, right? Mm-hmm. And over the years, then, by 1990, you have Latinoa theology being developed. The Protestant and Catholic community have come together and they're having dialogue and finding these new themes that are related to this experience. And those new themes are creating spaces for the doing of theology that are very rich.
This is one of the reasons I'm eager to be talking with you and with the Association for Hispanic Theological Education. It's been really neat for me for the last few years to be part of this exchange because I never interacted much with Hispanic churches prior to that. And just the opportunity to see how science and theology issues play out in a different tradition, a different culture. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from it. We've already talked about some of the things you've mentioned, like openness to questions and an emphasis on education, which can only help in these conversations. And I imagine there's even more theological insights we'll get as we talk more together. So going back a step, what has been your own experience with science? As you were learning it, did you see tensions between science and faith? And what about others in your family, the next generation in your family?
So I didn't see a lot of tension. I saw it among friends who were a part of other congregations.
Okay.
And I was able to discuss those pieces from the foundation that we had at my congregation, which I explained a few moments ago. And that was sort of really interesting because as I was growing up, again, I'm second generation. So what happened with the second generation is that we became leaders amongst our peers. Mm-hmm. And we tended to be youth ministers ourselves. I remember one time we had a retreat and it was just something that sort of came out because we were outside. Now, we were from the city. We didn't get to go out a whole lot, right? Mm. So here we are singing, "In His Stars, His Handiwork I See."
Mm. Oh, right? Beautiful.
And we're looking at the stars and there's a bonfire going on. And you know, it's a very informal thing, right? So right after we did that song, somebody goes, "So tell me something, what are the stars?" What are they made out of, you know? And did they just sort of, you know, get together, a bunch of gases came together? How's God's hand in that, right? So now this is a lot of peers there, right? And so we begin to talk about what we learned in school, what we learned in this congregation or that congregation, what this pastor said or the other. And you have this really interesting conversation going on. There's no scientist that can sit there and help put this together. It's just us between the bits of the things that we knew or didn't know, who was older, who was in higher grades, et cetera, and who had what explanations. But it was extremely interesting, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that such curiosity was there as we grew up, as we've grown up, we've continued to ask questions at different levels, and again, to seek each other out, to share what information we do have. Mm-hmm. And at this point, of course, with the internet, even though the internet is there and you could go into yourself, but because you grew up navigating this in dialogue, we'll call each other out and say, hey, listen, I want you to take a look at thus and such site and tell me what you think, right? And we have these fantastic, you know, conversations.
Oh, that's so cool. I love that. And then what does it look like for the next generation in your family?
Well, it's interesting because my children have had more access to nature, right?
Yeah,
In New York, you know, the whole story of a tree grows in Brooklyn, not in my part of Brooklyn.
Oh.
We were lucky if we saw grass coming up out of a crack. I remember, like, you know, bending down and checking out the grass and feeling it because you didn't get to see that a whole lot, right?
Wow.
No parks. Every park is, you know, cement, et cetera, et cetera. People don't realize what that does. But they've had more access to nature, and they went camping. And so their questions came much quicker. Their connection to God through nature was a really beautiful thing to see.
Mm.
And then the body, they're athletes.
Oh, okay.
And so an athlete very early on has connection to how his or her body moves and what it does and how this is a gift and so forth. So those questions came quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my sister and I grow up in the same household, same church, etc. But as she comes into college, she goes away to college and moves closer to a more conservative brand of evangelicalism, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so as her daughter's growing up, and now my kids, there was a difference. She was homeschooling, and the homeschooling material that was available created a conflict between science and faith.
Okay.
My kids grow up with me, and they grow up around other conversations and so forth. And so it was really interesting when the cousins came together, and they're finding that they're being taught really differently and that they see this really differently. So they come to us, their moms.
Oh.
And now my sister and I have to ask, you know, we're being asked these questions and we have to ask ourselves what's going on. And I said to her, where did you pick this up and why? That's not how we grew up. And we began to have a new conversation. And she said, but this is the material we have for homeschoolers. I said, yes, but you more than I, because my sister moved into the sciences professionally more than I did, as she was, she is an occupational therapist, right? I said, how is it that you can blend your understanding as a healer with your faith, but you're not connecting this piece for your daughter?
Yeah.
So I challenged her to use material that did not come from where she was using it and to try to make the connections herself differently.
Yeah.
And that then turned into a whole other experience, because now she becomes a person who can challenge other homeschoolers.
Ah.
But on the same token, they're feeling like, oh, she's a dangerous person. Right. So it's just gets interesting because it has to do with who it is that you come in contact with, what circles you're in, and how those different circles are looking at these pieces.
So you've done a lot of work on racial reconciliation and social justice. And so I'd like to talk about how science plays into that. I know science has not always had a positive role there, science and medicine. What does that look like in different Hispanic churches, and what kinds of problems are we facing?
So if you're poor in the United States, and because of the U.S. history, poverty tends to look differently in communities of color, right? Mm-hmm. But let's just talk about overall poverty pieces. Your schools are not going to expose you to the areas of science in the same way. Right. You won't have the same equipment. Mm. You won't have the same opportunities and experiences because of not having equipment and so forth. So we need to talk about how it is that pastors understand that side of it so that children can be exposed to science more deeply.
Right. I've heard you mention how some of the children in poverty just aren't exposed to role models. They just have no concept of what it might be like to be in a science career.
That's right. So science fairs become really important pieces, and hearing as a part of that fair to have a section where you can see someone who is a scientist that comes from your background, and that they can talk about how they became a scientist, what their work looks like, how they contribute to the world, and so forth. If you're growing up with parents who are not professional, they're working class parents, you have no idea that these areas exist, yeah. Right? Yeah. And so especially, you want to start that from very, very young, but definitely, especially when you're coming into middle school, because that's mm-hmm. when young people begin to think of themselves as who they want to be more than anything else, right?
Mm-hmm. A lot of people listening to this are white and might have some scientific training. Is it helpful for a poor community that's predominantly Hispanic for a white person to come in and be a role model, or because there aren't yet a lot of Hispanics in science, so... But I would want to be culturally sensitive.
There are two dimensions to that.
Okay.
So first is the first resource you have is yourself. So if you want to be a part of a community, then come humbly. And when I say that, I mean find someone who can be a cultural broker for you.
Okay.
So that you're not just saying, here I come to save you all, you know,
yeah,
I'm a scientist,
that's the part
that I do X, right?
That's the part we don't want to do, but we want to help. But okay, so having somebody there who's...
who's going to be your broker. So let's say I can connect to a pastor, I can connect to a Sunday school teacher, I can connect to someone else who's teaching in my organization or what have you.
Okay.
But I want to be able to connect with that community. And and then as I'm getting to know them, there's a getting to know process before you jump into a doing process.
Yeah.
Then you see what it is that are possibilities, and you create them together with everyone else.
Yeah.
And that's one way. Another thing is that in today's day and age, as a white scientist, you have got to know a scientist that's not white, right? You can expand your networks.
Yeah.
And expanding your own networks to relate more to persons of color, that is a very important piece for your own development as a scientist.
That and is very true.
And so that we can also create these possibilities in other communities.
Yeah, yeah.
And let it be known that not all communities that are Hispanic are poor communities. There are professional communities, and there are second and third and up to seven generations of Latinos in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so persons are developed in other ways as well.
Yeah.
And those networks exist, and we should be more cognizant of them and more connected to them. I think that is something where one can be more proactive.
Yeah, that's a really good point of making the effort first in yourself to find peers of people of other ethnic and racial backgrounds so that you can get to know them as peers before walking into a community that you want to help. I think that's really important. Are there other challenges faced in encountering science and social justice issues?
Well, medicine.
Ah, yes. Let's talk about that.
So most medicines are tested on persons who are Caucasian, right? Our bodies have different antigens. Our biology, the chemistry of our bodies is different. So how you test medicines is very important, that we do that across the different races and so forth, because we do have differences. And that's really important, the research and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that means that you also want to have researchers who come from the different cultures.
Mm. Yes, that's another aspect.
Right? Yep. Because they will have insights into things that are taking place that someone else has not been exposed to because they didn't grow up seeing those things, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's important. If I go for a mammogram, they're going to find certain things in my mammogram that are going to be normal for Puerto Rican women, which are not necessarily normal for non-Puerto Rican women.
Oh.
It's just that we tend to have, you know, more tissue in certain places in terms of how we're built. Yeah. And so they'll always say to me, well, you know, we found an abnormality. And I'll say, oh, yeah, I'm Puerto Rican. This is what you found.
Oh, wow. Right? It comes up every
and
time.
It comes up. So it's like, okay, we got to put that down, right? Yeah. So when I ask, on one occasion, I said, would you please do me a favor and call up a lab in Puerto Rico and find out what it is that they're finding in the mammograms of Puerto Rican women there?
Yeah.
I really pushed, okay? I really, really pushed because they don't think that they can hear this woman of color say that, right? It sounds like I'm saying you can't do your job, which is not. What I want to say is please be exposed to more, right?
Yeah.
I trust that you're doing your job. Therefore, I trust that you could be exposed to more.
Yeah.
And finally, when they did it, they called me and they said, you know, thank you very much. This was very enlightening.
Ah, there you go.
And I was like, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's something to this. Now, I'm not a scientist, but just little things like that, that can spark for a scientist a whole other area.
Yeah.
And so how we come together in the world of science and honor these places of difference as ways of being able to bring greater healing to a greater group of persons.
So we've talked a lot about different kinds of tension points here in our conversation. When science and the Bible seem to be in conflict, science and theology, and also different racial tensions. There's a lot of times we're in conversations where there are barriers. I've heard you talk about the importance of humility and listening and overcoming barriers in your book, A Many-Colored Kingdom. You've talked about the importance of hospitality and dialogue. Can you say a little more about that and how we can overcome these tensions?
It's about opening up perspective. If you always think that you're right, no matter if it's a theological perspective, if it's science and how it relates to theology, if it's a theological standpoint, what have you. If you always think that you're right, then you must hold your theology as being static.
Mm. Yeah.
You can't grow from that point.
Right. There's nothing left to learn. If you're already right, there's nowhere to go.
That's right. But there are so many new things that are taking place, not only in terms of the natural sciences, but the social sciences as well, right? Mm-hmm. They're always opening up for us new worlds, new things for us to think about and to understand. And they're helping us to solve problems that are coming to us, right? We won't be able to come to the table with all of the tools available if we are so in conflict with something that we take it off the table.
Yeah.
And that impoverishes the options that can be created when you don't have all of those tools on the table.
Mm-hmm.
So in understanding what we're bringing to the table, I need to put what I think are my for real understandings right now, I need to put them on hold for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that I get rid of them. It means that I'm holding on to them,
okay,
while at the same time I'm opening the door to see things that where I'm coming from, it's not looking at that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not looking at these new areas. It doesn't have a way to solve these other pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I mean by putting it on hold, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that it's not operative.
Right.
But it means that it's not keeping something else out.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, allowing yourself to listen to at least another point of view.
That's right. Because perspective is extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
Perspective helps me to see an avenue that wasn't there before. And if we are co-creators with God, then we are always creating the world along with God.
Mm-hmm.
And we need everything that God has placed in the world for us,
mm-hmm,
to be able to do the creation of new pieces and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. Healings, the area of the care of the environment, which is, mm-hmm, so important, especially for me as one who goes back to Puerto Rico sees what's happening to the island due to the climate change, et cetera,
mm-hmm,
right? So all of these pieces are very important. Being able to look at the world differently. If you think about it, race was connected to science, right?
Mm.
All of the theories that said that persons of color, mm-hmm, could not learn in the same way, our brains didn't function the same way, etc., right?
Mm-hmm.
There was science connected to that. And even today, some people still try to revive those theories,
yeah,
right?
Mm.
So we have to be persons who are engaging those pieces so that the world that faith and science create, the values that hold us in looking at these disciplines and how they come together and how they help us to see alternatives of the world that we're in differently. That's very important,
mm-hmm,
right? Those,
yeah,
alternatives have values, and we create those values with knowledge. Not only theological knowledge, but the knowledge of the natural world, they have to go together,
mm-hmm,
if we're going to talk as a people about the kingdom of God,
yeah,
and those values. Creating the values of the kingdom of God in our midst today in every discipline is extremely important.
Yes. Yes, we need to value the natural world and the process of science as something that's part of our faith, and that's part of this wonderful table laid before us of all the things that we consider when we're talking with one another and considering our faith. Well, thank you, Dr. Conde Fraser. It has been wonderful to have you here and to hear these words of your wisdom, your experience, and I think it'll be inspiring for our listeners. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Language of God is produced by BioLogos. It has been funded in part by the John Templeton Foundation and more than 300 individuals who donated to our crowdfunding campaign. Language of God is produced and mixed by Colin Hugerwerf, with additional production assistance by Truthworks Media. Our theme song is by Breakmaster Cylinder. We are produced out of the BioLogos offices in Grand Rapids, Michigan. If you have questions or want to join in a conversation about this episode, find the link in the show notes for the BioLogos forum. Find more episodes of Language of God on your favorite podcast app or at our website, biologos.org, where you'll also find tons of great articles and resources on faith and science. Finally, if you're enjoying the show and want to help us out, leave a review on iTunes. We love hearing from you, and it helps other people find the show. Thanks.